And you're listening to WMRWLP Warren 95.1 FM and streaming live at WMRW.org. And as always, boys and girls, the following program represents the opinion of the producer and participants and does not represent the views of WMRWLP or its license holder Roots Work. And we actually have participants tonight, members from the Root Boy Slim and the Sex Change Band are here with us tonight. We're going to get them hooked up here soon so we can chit-chat. This is probably the first time I've interviewed people that are like God's disciples, put on amazing shows, and I love the music because it's in your face and it's pretty blunt with a blues kind of twist. And, they've always had good people in the band. When I saw them in Frederick, Maryland back in the early 80s, there was a plethora of our local musicians that were playing, such as Scotty Ambush and Deanna Bogart and many, many more. And it was one hell of a good time. And actually got to talk to Root Boy. Didn't have the Percocets, you know, but I did and was able to purchase alcohol. And fantastic show. Toilet Seats, Ray Gunn. I mean, but the thing that is incredible about the Sex Change Band and Root Boy Slim is that the music is top-notch. The lyrics are unique, but they hit home. And they're talking about funny things, weird things, what is actually going on in your world, but doing it with a twist. Or shall we say, twisted. So we're going to get Dick and Ernie on the line here. And until then, we'll do a little orientation into Root Boy Slim and the Sex Change Band. Are you ready?
Yeah. got to get serious with you one time. I see you just sitting there patting your feet and clapping along, and some of you are hollering and screaming. I don't see the dance floor crowded with people doing the game. I want to see you out there horizontally doing that horizontal step. Everybody knows how to do the gator. You might have done it last night in the privacy of your own home. When you crawl outside and see the police come, just ask those cops to get down and gator some. Don't be a hesitator. Don't ask the waiter. It'll take you to the gator. I gotta talk to you people real seriously, like, you know, heart to heart. We're worried about you. Not enough people out there doing the gator on the floor while you're listening to this tune. Want you to get down there, horizontal. Get down there with your baby or your wife, maybe. Do anything you want. But you can gator in your car. Just pull over to the side and gator in the front seat. You can gator on the train. You can gator on a plane. Underwater, you can gator all over the place. You can gator in a hurricane.
I stay in this lonely room, watching the gong show and thinking of you. Loneliest chair, loneliest bed, loneliest deja vu, in the loneliest, 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 loneliest room in the world. I tried marijuana, cocaine, and heroin, but they just can't seem to get the thought of you out from under my skin. I'm lonelier now, lonelier than I've ever been, in the loneliest, 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 loneliest room in the world. Phone never rings, postman never brings a thing, even the singles clubs won't give me a whirl. Plants all dead, even my cactus, beer cans round my bed, in the loneliest room in the world. I tried marijuana, cocaine, and heroin. Can't seem to get the thought of you out from under my skin. I'm the loneliest man, lonelier than I've ever been, in the loneliest, loneliest, loneliest room in the world. I'm not sorry for myself. I'm sorry for that Miss Wright who can't find me. Miss Wright, I'm thinking of you tonight in your lonely room. The singles clubs won't even answer your phone. You got the blues. Low bounce. singles club blues in the loneliest room in the world. Your room might even be lonelier than my room, my darling baby. It's lonely. Music. The shy is gone. He gone away. The shy is gone. Living in L.A. There's something about the weather, another cat he could not stay. He went on a long vacation. He stopped on Egypt and Paris. He went on a long vacation. He stopped in Egypt and Gay Paris. I hope he brought some of that good old Lebanese. No, wait a minute, that's Danny Thomas. He's from, this cat's from Iran. The Shah is gone. You know he's gone to stay. The Shah is gone. Heard he's moving to L.A. You know he's on long, long vacation. Ain't coming back your way. You know his citizens, they didn't dig his act. You know them Iranians, they did not dig his act. Throwing rocks and shooting at the limo on the way to the airport and on the way back. You know the Shah is gone. He's gone to stay. You know the Shah is gone. Heard he's moving to L.A. Won't be back, you Iranian, so put your Tommy guns away. Pretty soon you'll forget him, he'll be a distant memory. Pretty soon you'll forget him, he'll be a distant memory. He'll be sitting by the poolside, counting your money. The Shah is gone.
Oh my God,
won't
I tell
you. Be back.
And there you have it. The Shah is gone, which is still relevant to today's political scene that's going on. And these are one of the things that I've been telling you about Root Boy Slim and the Sex Change Band, is that their songs talk about what is happening in many different ways. And we have Ernie Lancaster and Dick Bangman. Are you both there?
I'm here.
Okay, and Ernie, you're there, right?
I'm here.
Okay, perfect. So I guess I'm just going to put this first question out here. Is how did you meet Root Boy? And either one of you can go first.
Oh. Well, I guess I met him first, didn't I, Dickie? I met him in about 19, Hey, well, let's see. Probably about 75, maybe. And he and Bob Greenlee had been college pals and bandmates. And Slim used to come down to Florida and visit Bob. And I was in a band then around here, an original music band, and they came over to where we were rehearsing at my house one day, and we all just got to be buddies, and we wound up working with those guys, and so that's where I met him. He came to my house to get me.
So it was like a chance meeting.
I met him a couple years later. Oh, by the way, Ernie was saying that he and Bob Greenlee were in school together in college. That was Yale. They were frat brothers, and one of their frat brothers was George W. Bush.
Yeah, Yale, not the locksmith school, the other Yale.
Yeah.
Nice.
He was the year behind. Bush was a year behind him, and I don't think he missed. And Root Boy was, Bob Greenlee was captain of the football team. Root was
an All-American.
What?
Bob was an All-American at Yale, and
that's right.
He was drafted by the Miami Dolphins, and he asked himself, "Do I want to be 35 and a has been and walk funny?" So he skipped the Dolphins.
He skipped the Dolphins, and he skipped Yale Law, and decided to go into rock and roll and blues, be a musician.
So he had all these choices, and he chose Root Boy.
Yeah, well he chose music.
And yeah, it wasn't Root Boy. It would have been hard to resist the lifestyle, and you know, living on a lake in Central Florida and in the 70s, you know, pretty nice.
Mm-hmm. Nice. So then how did you end up coming up with being part of the band, Ernie? I mean, he came and visited you, you played, but like, what made you decide to
They like my playing, so we I went over to Bob's. He had a garage apartment, a studio apartment, and there was we had a 2-track TAC set up out there at the time, and we would go over and just record some stuff and work on demos, and you just do crazy outlandish stuff, and also spend some considerable time applying ourselves to pretty much conventional songwriting as well. But that's where we really got tied in. You know, when Slim wasn't down here, Bob and I would get together several days a week to write. So, I don't know, we just started playing together more and more, and it just sort of happened. They were both 9 years older than I, and we just got along great, though, and they sort of accepted me as the third wheel, or the third part of the troika, or not to use a word that's popular today in the news.
So Dick, how are you involved in the band?
Well, it was in 77 that I met Slim. He was from the D.C. area. Root Boy was pretty patrician upbringing. His father was a landscape architect. Foster McKenzie the third. He got thrown out of all the finer private schools, and somehow wound up at Yale. He came back. He came up. He'd been spent a lot of time in Florida. He had a band down there, and I met him through a mutual friend. He had a little demo tape with three songs on it that those guys, it turns out, had recorded in what they called the Mood Barn, which is like a little sort of garage in Daytona Beach. As Ernie said, they had a little TAC 4-track. So they demoed up three songs. I think it was I Want It Now, Used to Be a Radical, and Mood Ring.
Mood Ring, right.
I heard the tape and saw some pictures of him before I actually met him. And I said, wow, this is something I haven't heard before. And then this mutual friend of ours, Joe Lee, had us both. He says, you want to meet this guy? Because I was at the time was looking around to do some sort of recording project. I've been doing a lot of album covers and working in studios. And I wanted to do something from the inside out. So he arranged a meeting, the three of us, Joe and Root and I, played Scrabble one night.
Scrabble, nice.
Yeah. And I met this guy, you know, he was like 6 foot three or four, you know, approaching 300 pounds, deep set eyes that could just look right through you. But otherwise he was dressed kind of Collegian. He had a sweater on and he just shook his hand. He was real polite and he introduced himself. I'm Root Boy Slim. And on the way out that night, he asked me if I would help him get famous. So I said, well, I'll see what I can do. And then a couple months later, we said, okay, well, let's start working some stuff. So Joe booked some gigs and I got some studio time at a local studio up in the DC area. And Root went back down to Florida to the band and said, look, I got some guys that are going to get us some gigs and put up some studio time. Let's go do an album. So that was the first time I met Ernie and Bob and the rest of the band. They came up from Florida. I think they played at a club called the Psychedelic. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, I remember the Psychedelic.
On my birthday, April 1st, 77. And it was a mind-blowing show. There'd been, some word around town. People had been talking about it and heard about it, but nobody actually seen him perform. And then he brings up this killer band, the Sex Change Band from Florida. And none of us knew each other or what to expect, and the whole thing just came together that night. It was just amazing. The crowd went crazy. We all got along fine, and immediately went in the studio and started working on what became the Warner Brothers album about 6 months later.
Now that first show at the Psychedelic, were you playing all original music at that point? Because is the first album, is it the, well, it's basically self-titled with the Boogie Till You Puke and all that. Is that the first album?
Yes, it is the eponymous first album.
So, Ernie, what was that first show at the Psychedelic like for you?
It was wild. It was wild for me. We'd been down here in Florida and we'd been really spending a lot of time kind of writing and recording, but I was still... Bob and I actually started doing some gigs by that time, and we were doing some bands, some gigs in the Lake Joanna Band with great drummer Tommy Ruger, who was our original Sex Change Band drummer, and he had achieved earlier fame regionally at least with the Nightcrawlers and their regional hit song Little Black Egg, which is one of the first songs I ever played with my bands on a gig. Little Black Egg, what a classic, and great pedal steel player, guitar player, Walter Andrews, Cosmo Creek, and the late, great Winston Kelly on Hammond B3 organ and piano and vocals. And he was just a sensational musician and a very experienced gigger, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He'd come up playing in a black club in Daytona, and it really, you know, got an inside scoop on hard gigging, you know, so... We learned a lot from each other, and so we coalesced into this thing, and we wound up with these tunes, as Dick was saying. We started in the Boom Boom Room where the two track was, and we wound up, as Dick said, with the four track over the Mood Barn, and got some of these tunes happening, and they came very quickly, and it was a lot of fun writing because it was really everybody was just dialed in and very. Turned on to write and to be creative and have fun with the whole thing, because the sky was the limit and there were no boundaries or stylistic constraints or anything like that. So we were free to just have a ball, and we were young and ready to do that. And so I don't know if you know this part of the story, but Slim used to come down, and we were playing gigs down here with this Lake Joanna band, and we were backing this this Elvis impersonator, sort of a diminutive guy. He was great, named Danny Dollar. He liked blackberry wine a little bit too much, but we were playing at this little place. What's the name of it? It's owned by the Gibby and Snake, I think, were their names. And, it was right behind, let's say, a strip bar, strip joint in Daytona, in a pretty seedy joint. And we were there with Danny Dollar, and we were Danny Dollar and Change for this thing. So Slim said, when I sit in, it's got to be Root Boy Slim and Sex Change. That's where that came from. And he got up on stage, and there was a little singer's platform there, and he promptly put his foot through it up to his knee about. And we were off from then, you know, as far as our little thing, just the band and Slim. Then, you know, later on, the Rudettes came to be very, very shortly thereafter. A couple of girls, the Smiley Sisters from the New Smyrna Beach, Florida area, got with us, and that was kind of a wild trip because they were kind of wild, and like one of them carried a gun, and I don't know.
you gotta be prepared.
They were along for the ride, and they couldn't sing very much, and but they could dance, and you know, and dress up.
Nice. So Dick, what's your opinion on the Rootettes? Were you involved in that too, or?
Yeah. Well. Once we started touring, and the Smiley Sisters, right? Huh?
Dick is king of the Rudettes.
That's right. I was somehow I wound up with a job of auditioning Rudettes because I remember after the first trip or two, one of the Smiley Sisters dropped out and found Jesus.
Oh God!
And the other one, I guess, it was Susan and Becky, and then Becky stayed on for a little while. We got Sherry Grasso, old friend of mine from high school, that we'd had a band together, to step in, and I guess Becky stayed with her for a while. Then she got pregnant, so that was the end of the Smiley Sisters. So then we picked up Marina.
Made it die, man. Come on,
Marina, Johnny, Mickey. Who was a good friend of Sherry's, and so those became sort of the working Rudettes, and they're the ones who wound up going to Miami when we started recording the real album. During this all happened like between April of '77, and by the end of that summer, Steely Dan. Who had gotten a hold of a tape, and their producer, Gary Katz, was starting to come and see some of the shows in D.C. And Katz said, look, you guys want to record for Warner Brothers. We were getting ready to put the album out on our own, just on our own, or get some independent label, and suddenly Warner Brothers is on the phone saying, well, why don't you guys record with us?
Well, hey, one step I remember, now you mentioned that we recorded this 16-track demo at Track Studios.
Right. Yeah, we had an album for the material.
And it got it. Yeah, it was on the radio there on WHFS, and it was like the number 3 album of the year or something on the station. Just our demo tape.
Right. Yeah. Which wound up getting in Fagan's hands, and he played it for Gary Katz, and they both had pretty much the same reaction that I had the first time I heard the demo. From the Mood Barn was like, what the hell is this?
One moment here. You're listening to WMRW LP Warren 95.1 FM and streaming live at WMRW.org. And we are here with Ernie Lancaster and Dick Bagman of Root Boy Slim and the Sex Change Band. So Steely Dan got, where did they get the demo from? I mean, I'm just finding this combination of Steely Dan and the Sex Change Band. It seems unnatural, okay?
There again, another great DJ is in the mix. Josh Brooks had gone to prep school, gone to Bard with Donald and Walter. And so they were old buddies, and Josh was a HFS DJ, and he was our champion there.
And WHFS, you may remember that, was like our local DC area FM station, yep. Progressive Radio.
Amazing. That
broke a lot of national acts like Little Feat, Bonnie Raitt, Bruce Springsteen, you know, certainly in the D.C. area. And they started playing the Root Boy demo tapes just whenever we'd have a song or two recorded, because the recording went on during that spring and summer. Those guys were writing material, and whenever they come up, we'd go in the studio for a few days and knock out a couple more songs. So the HFS would just start playing them, and it was, like Ernie said, it was one of the top three most requested albums of the year on WHFS, and it wasn't even an album yet.
No, and they played it a lot, because I can remember that. That's probably the first place I ever heard Root Boy was on HFS, which was an amazing station, which is sad that it is not still here, because it was so cutting edge and so far ahead and allowed bands like yours to exist, and it was amazing.
Yeah.
So
anyway, 6 months later, Kat says, where do you guys want to record? Pretty much we could go anywhere in the world, really. And Bob and Ernie, both being from Florida, asked, let's record at Criteria Studios in Miami, which is where the Bee Gees are recorded. Clapton, James Brown. Bob Marley came in one day while we were down there to record.
The weather, sorry.
Yeah, Jimmy Buffett. So that was a trip. And, of course, Steely Dan, Fagan, and Becker were attending most of the sessions, just hanging out and listening, just enjoying, soaking it all up.
So what did they like about you? What drew Steely Dan to you? I mean, you talked to him a bunch. What was up?
Well, I think the humor behind it. Steely Dan, if you really listen to their material, it's certainly, I wouldn't compare it at all with Root Boy, other than they both have very dark and humor going on. And I think that's what drew him to it.
Yeah, I think that, you know, Slim Ray possessed a lot of gravitas. He was a kind of a blend of Orson Welles and Milton Berle, you know.
I see just, that.
Just, you know, larger than life and incredibly smart guy. Just, you know, he could get right to he could triangulate something right to a new perspective, you know, and he was an incredible character. I mean, love him or hate him, I think most people could feel the presence of this guy. He was a very funny guy, funniest guy I ever knew, I think.
And when he got on stage, he was a real powerhouse as a showman.
Oh, yeah.
He would do anything. He was not afraid to make a complete fool out of himself, puke on stage, sticks. Head in the bass drum, turn the drum solo.
And the roadies would put down a towel and he'd dance on top of the towel, you know.
And people started, the crowds, the fans would start bringing stuff. I remember somebody started bringing rutabagos and throwing them up on stage. And then there were Fruit Loops, and they would scratch the F off of the Fruit Loops box and they'd become Root Loops. And people would throw Root Loops up there. And so he'd work all that in the act.
I think that, yeah, we turned that around backwards. We scratched the F off and threw out the Root Loops.
Oh, that's right.
That's right.
And it was funny going to the shows. It was like, it was totally crazy in Bedlam, but somehow it seemed like controlled and it flowed. Like, at least the shows I'd gone to, it didn't really get mean. It was just a good, fun time. The smiles on people's faces. And the thing I noticed when I saw y'all in Frederick was you were playing with a lot of local musicians there, Deanna and Scotty and others. And the looks on their faces, like, they loved playing with you guys. I mean, you could just see it. It was just like, wow. And then the whole crowd was just awe and into it. And it was just like such a fun time. It was like beyond belief. I've never really been to anything quite like that.
It was a real no two shows were ever the same, you know, other than the material. But you never really knew what to expect from a Root Boy show, other than you were going to, you know, let all your inhibitions, were going to just go leave those at the door, and everybody was going to go in there and get crazy together.
Yeah, and a safe environment to do it in, somewhat.
Somewhat.
I don't know how safe.
Oh, this is great.
No, actually, we were caused a little trouble because some of our fans would just get really a lot of control afterwards, and they would go outside. And I remember at one point they did some vandalism and broke gas pumps and stuff and got in fights. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't because of us. I think it was kind of some of the self-medication was...
Yeah, it happens that way sometimes. You can't control that, you know?
Anyway, they were, you know, not doing the peaceful kind of things. But we got in trouble. In fact, we got banned from was Prince George's County?
Prince George's County, yeah.
How can you get banned for Prince George's County? Go ahead.
Our fans were causing trouble, and they just decided that it was better off if we didn't play there or something like that. Wild West or something.
Yeah, I thought Prince George's County was the Wild West.
Later on, a superior judge, district judge, repealed that, so we were able to go back and play there again. Because that's a shame, because we really enjoyed playing there. We had a great fan base out there, and we made pretty good money out there, too. We hated to lose those gigs for 6 months.
So it was only a short period.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, so, all right, so you signed on with Warner Brothers, then what started happening? As far as career-wise?
Well, there was we all thought, whoa, this is it. We're on our way, you know?
Yeah, we had a 7-album deal.
Yeah. We went out to, after finished recording in Florida, we went out to L.A. to do the final mix. While we were out there, got the tour through Warner Brothers Records. Katz was introducing us to everybody. Fagan and Becker were, of course, hanging out for the mixing and everything. And a lot of some of the execs from Warner Brothers would come by the studio. Martin Mull was down the hall recording Sex and Violins, and we kept calling him Marty Mull on Route 66. And he didn't know what to make of it. We had tour support. It was the end of the great heydays of the record business. There was equipment budget. Ernie got new guitar. Everybody got new instruments that wanted them. I got some video gear so I could start videotaping the shows. We ended up sending a videotape up to Saturday Night Live right after the album had come out. Didn't hear anything for a while, and then one day Slim calls me up and says, who's Michael O'Donohue? And I said, well, why are you asking? He's the head writer for Saturday Night Live, and I just recited his whole resume. He used to be a writer for National Lampoon, and he says, well, he's doing a special for Saturday Night Live, and he wants us to perform. And I said, really? So we thought, yeah, we're things are happening. But in the meantime, Katz had set up a showcase show in Los Angeles at the Roxy. It was invitation only, and Chevy Chase was there. Lindsay, the Million Dollar Woman.
Was she there? Whoever.
And who was the head of Warner Brothers at the Warner Brothers Records?
Was it Mo Austin or? Yeah. I think Bob Ruggiero was there. Ruggiero was there.
Anyway, Slim had had a pretty eventful afternoon at the Chateau Marmont, and showed up pretty pretty much wasted at the show. Well, not that that mattered, really.
What happened there, I think, was really, we didn't have a crowd of real people. We had movies and record executives and, you know, jaded. It just wasn't going to happen for us that night, and it didn't.
So what was that show like then? Was it like, it's like you're playing at Carnegie Hall and there are a bunch of uptight people that don't get it?
It was more like a zoo almost, because we were on stage, Slim was swinging from pipes and stuff, and it wasn't a very coherent show. He was a little too jacked up and animated, and it was a tough show, and we weren't feeling it at all. Everybody was kind of nervous because we just couldn't get together with these people, you know, the crowd.
I remember Variety did a review of the show, and they said the funniest thing he did was take an encore.
right.
Well, I mean, that sort of proves that the audience is very important with you all, because that just, you feed off each other, basically.
Well, the thing is, I remember that very clearly, but before we even got off stage, Bob turning around almost knocking me over to get back up, because we weren't going to let him get away before we could squeeze in another try, you know?
Nope.
I want more, man.
So what was the encore? What was the last song?
No, I don't. Do you remember, Dick? I don't.
Probably Boogie Till You Puke.
Who knows? Might have been Express Train or something like that. I don't know.
Anyway, that show was kind of the turning point with Warner Brothers. They just sort of lost interest.
They're spending our money on them.
Yeah, they said, we just spent $250,000 on this.
No more limos for these guys.
So basically, it was one show that changed everything. Like, they didn't go and watch you in clubs to see how people reacted to you.
Well, Gary Katz had.
He
loved it. You know, he was really impressed by the caliber of musicians with the band too. And I think that's another thing that impressed Fagan and Becker, was musicianship was really tight, and perfect, perfectly synced with this crazy guy Root Boy.
They used Walter, our steel player, on this song FM.
Right.
Oh, really?
This thing, no static at all.
Yeah. Wow.
That signature lick, that's our steel player, Walt.
Yeah, how many rock and roll bands have you heard that with a pedal steel guitar? that was just part of the unique sound.
We had Ron Holloway, too, and we kind of arranged things, so they played a lot of lines together, and it was sounding sort of like a hybrid instrument of steel and sax, and couldn't quite, you know, make out what it was, but it was a very captivating, appealing sound. And then, of course, those guys loved the way Ron played. Gary had him play on a Mark Jordan album while we were in the studio and had a little downtime from our record.
That's Ron Holloway, sax player.
He plays with Government Mule now, and the Almonds and Derek and all those guys.
Huh.
Yeah, he's been touring with Warren Haynes right now.
I mean, because your sound was different, because, I'm seeing like blues, rock and roll influence, but the fusion and the way you put it together, it just, I just couldn't call it blues, I couldn't call it rock, I don't know, it was just very, very distinct. And to me, musically, the band was very, very tight. Vocals and instrumentation. I mean, Ernie, were you involved in writing music?
I wrote about 95% of the music outfit. I wrote ten songs or less in that period. The music was my thing, and I was really about kind of having some uniqueness about it without being far out. I wanted to be relatable, and, you know, have a southern sort of American rock sort of southern sound to it, you know, blues influence, but we, you know, anything goes at the top, because I loved Captain Beefheart, and and I loved where we were going, you know, that we could take some sort of a foundation, an accessible form like that, and then put anything we wanted on top of it.
Yeah, because, I mean, to me, the music is freaking amazing. I mean, because, I mean, I can't even really describe what you did. I'm like, mind is blown because it's like upbeat and, you know, and you get in the bluesy, like the mellower stuff. But, I mean, it was just so, like, on it, you know.
Well, thanks, Dan. What we're really trying to do, I was really trying to focus on, and Bob, too, was trying to make the tunes good vehicles for Slim's characters, because he was a different character in every tune, pretty much. You know, of course, he was always Rude Boy Slim.
Right.
But it was, you know, some other customized miscreant, you know, so it was... You know, they were all different facets of his personality, and we tried to have different vehicles for him so he could just get off on it, like Loneliest Room in the World, something like that. You know, that's pretty much a throwback to doo-wop music and stuff, you know. So we weren't concerned about any sort of genre or anything like that. We knew we could make it real and play it with conviction and make it sincere, but at the same time new on top of a conventional form.
So now would lyrics come first, or would it be sort of just a mix of the both, or how did it come about?
Often it would be a lick, like a hook or something, like in the case of Boogie to Your Puke. That was actually Winston's hook, and we had almost finished the first demo, the first 16-track demo, and that's one of the last tunes we were cutting. We hadn't really finished the lyrics yet, so we went to Shepherd's Park one day. We actually went to the park, not the strip club, but the park between a hotel and the strip club, and we fleshed out the lyrics there in about 30 minutes, and we were good to go with that one. And so sometimes it would be... Sometimes I might have the music and Slam, we'd play it, you know, for Slam, and he would get something from it, and, you know, he'd throw something on it, and we'd go from there. Then we'd write the lyrics, we'd form it all up, and make it in some sort of song structure with the verses and a, you know, chorus, a bridge, whatever, you know, solos.
Oh, okay, well...
All right,
so then the album Left 4 Dead, basically that was pretty spontaneous. Was it like recorded in like one or two takes, or how was this whole album done?
Oh, absolutely. We went in track studios one night, and we were just determined. We had a couple of things that we'd been messing with. We just didn't have time to record them, and we really hadn't finished making songs out of any of them. We'd slam out a few hook ideas, a few lines, and this and that, and I had some grooves, and Bob had some grooves, and we went in, and everybody just we'd kick off a groove, and Slim would go, and for the most of it, I think we did like 22 tunes all together that night, and almost all of them were pretty much fully fleshed out after one take, two at the top, you know, at the most probably. I don't think we'd spend any more time than that.
Right. Yeah, that's pretty amazing because it's a great album, you know. And that's the thing that gets me about you guys is that it's just it has the spontaneous feel to it. All the songs, it just they seem like they were natural and they just happened.
Well, you know, that we were wise enough to surround ourselves with really good musicians, and on that station in particular, Bob and I. The drummer, Albert, was the drummer. Albert Bache was the drummer on that particular session. And we'd try to lay down a foundation. We had Stuart Smith with us in the studio. He's an Eagle now. He's the fifth Eagle, I guess. But he was, you know, he was playing this beautiful slide stuff and great guitar. So we were kind of laying out vehicles, you know, for people to play on and Slim to get off on. And it worked out very well. I'm kind of not thrilled with, you know, what I wound up playing on it because I couldn't really concentrate on that. I didn't even have a sound for that. I was just trying to, you know, make something happen on the bottom end.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. that session was kind of typical of I was, you know, went down to Florida a couple times just when these guys were in their writing modes. You know, they'd go, Bob and Ernie and Rupo would get together for about a week, just go back, sit in a, Bob had a little studio behind his house that eventually became Kingsnake Records. And they'd bring, you know, a drummer and Winston and just basically just sit around and jam for a week. Root Boy would have some ideas and Ernie would have some licks and then that's how they'd kind of come up with the material. And then Bob would sort of edit it, the lyrics into something that was, you know, accessible. And so I think they try, that's how most of the songwriting's, that was their modus operandi. So this Left 4 Dead was really, let's just turn the machines on, go into the studios and do it like we always do. So there wasn't a lot of time, like Ernie was saying, there wasn't any follow-up for overdubs or any kind of studio polish. But again, it's a testament to just how tight this band was and how quick-witted Root Boy was, that they could knock out a song in one take from scratch. And not just one song, but an entire album and a half worth of material. We got to get those other songs out. There's another album there that would never been released.
I'll be waiting for that for sure. So then after Warner chickened out, because like when I left Maryland, I thought for sure you guys were going to be big and I was going to be hearing you on radio all over the place, you know, and then it didn't happen, which always made me wonder, you know. And so what do you all end up doing after Warner Brothers?
Well, they gave us it's been said they gave us $40,000 to go away.
We had a two album contract with them, or an option for a second album, and we also had a really good music lawyer, Paul Schindler, out of New York, they just to be get rid of us, to be through with us, they gave us another $40,000. So
I think we owed them $208,000 when we left,
right, something like that. So that money just went into working on a second album, which became Zoom.
Sales for a little while, and so we could write and record Zoom, and it worked out great.
Yeah, Zoom was actually, I think, a more seasoned album than the first one, just because, you know, we'd been through a year working with you know, Cats and Steely Dan
we kind of learned how to make a good record from them, you know.
Yeah. So Bob and Ernie produced Zoom. That tape found its way to at one point, this was when Rolling Stones had their own label, Rolling Stones Records, and we had a somebody we knew worked at Rolling Stones Records, and it was being considered as a release on that label, which we were all, of course, just thrilled about. The only other artist other than the Rolling Stones that they'd ever released was Bill Wyman did a solo album, and Peter Tosh. So we were in a very exclusive group of people had we been released on Rolling Stone, but Rolling Stone Records. But that was taking a while, and we taped the Nando video show while we were still shopping the second album around. And I think you guys had done a gig out in California at some place, some point. I wasn't there, but I think you shared a plane ride with Ian Dury and the Blockheads. Somewhere along the line.
You ran into them in San Francisco at the airport, I think.
Right. And so, of course, Slim gave him a copy of his album. So somewhere in this period while, you know, we were still shopping Zoom and doing Mondo Video, we get a call from Ian Dury saying, would you guys like to come, be my support, my opening act for my summer tour? England and Scotland. So we said, yeah. And then I guess it was Paul Schindler. Once we knew that was happening, we had an album in the can ready to go. Rolling Stones were still kind of hemming and hawing about it. They weren't in any big hurry. So Miles Copeland, who at the time was Stuart Copeland's brother, he was managing the Police, who were just getting started out in England, and he had started his own label called Illegal Records. So he called and said, why don't you guys put it out on Illegal? Since we were coming over there to tour, and Ian Dury's tour was going to be a pretty big, it was already a sold out tour. So we released Zoom on Illegal Records while we were over touring with Ian Dury and the Blockheads. And then when we came home, we were over there for 3 months, the summer of 79. We came back and IRS Records, which was Miles Copeland, basically started IRS Records in the U.S., distributed by A&M. So we were back on another major label, more or less, at A&M, via IRS, and was one of the first 10 releases or so that they had put out.
So what was Scotland and Britain like touring there? And the people, how'd they get into it?
We were really very well received, and particularly by the Blockheads, we got along great with. They were great guys, and I think we're kind of kindred spirits. At the end of every show, for the encore, they do Ian's big hit song, Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll, and he'd bring all of us out. They said, let's bring out our friends from America, Root Boy Slim and the Sex Change Band. And so there'd be like 16 people up on stage doing Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll at the end of the night every night. something to behold.
Nice. So what do you think of it, Ernie?
I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And the press liked us pretty well over there, too. We had our Dare to be Fat was our single release when we were there, and it was pick hit of the week in Record Mirror, was it?
Yeah.
And actually, we were kind of embarrassed to overshadow the Blockhead single that week in the press, because theirs was Reasons to Be Cheerful. Was that what it was?
Reasons to Be Cheerful, I think.
And it met with a maybe pallid approval, and they seemed to dig our record, but the Blockheads just blew my mind. They were so fantastic. They were just great. They're the best sounding live band I'd ever heard to that date. We had like half a Pink Floyd's sound system and half the Rolling Stones light system, lighting gear in there, lighting director, Pip Foster. We had the greatest engineers and crews. They're just top flight. Wow. We were blown away.
And, of course, you know, we were on a really organized tour with on big stages and big crowds, and that was something, again, everybody really learned from that, just adding more polish to our show.
We just fumbling around over here,
So was that your first big audiences then when you went to Scotland?
No, we played big shows over here by then.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it was, how many shows did we do there? Like 60 shows and.
We did 40 with them. And we had a couple of, we played the Reading Festival, and we also had, we played a club gig in London there.
Yeah. Dingwalls, which is still there. It's really this club in London.
Oh, okay. So then that went on for 3 months, and you came back to the States, and then what was going on? So you were with, IRS at that point?
The IRS, and so the album came out in the States when we came back.
And I think that's when we did Mondo Video. I think that's when we
That's when it was supposed to air. Mondo Video was supposed to air that fall. As a Saturday Night Live would do three shows a month, and then the fourth weekend used to be a weekend update. I think it was with Lloyd Dobbins and Liz Ellerby. And then that show was canceled, so Saturday Night Live pretty much owned that weekend. So this was going to be the first of a series of specials. And Fred Silverman was the president of NBC at the time, which was pretty much in the toilet ratings-wise at that point, except for Saturday Night Live. This was the fifth year, I think, of the original cast of Saturday Night Live. And they ruled television. It was the most creative thing happening on television.
Amazing.
And but Fred Silverman just said, "Over my dead body, will this air?" So.
Why was it too extreme? Is this is the video with all the blow up dolls in the club, or is this something different?
No, that's it.
But our segment that was trouble for him. I don't know how bad ours was for him, but the rest of the film, I mean. The underlying statement of the film was about silly censorship. You know, it was based on Mondo Cani. And things they would show, for example, there's a clip in there where it shows topless natives, Aboriginal, you know, women dancing around a campfire. Then there's a quick cut to topless African American women dancing around a fire in a motel room or something, but they're dressed the same. But it's just a cultural flip, and it was the whole thing was kind of slanted to kind of tweak those sensibilities, you know.
Right.
And the way I understand it is they recut the thing three times, and they still couldn't get it past them. So. The way I remember it is that O'Donohue and Paul Klein, who was an NBC executive, used their own money, I think $750,000, to just buy it outright so they could release it theatrically, which really was sort of antithetical to the whole nature of the thing, because it was about skewing TV and censorship and. So it didn't play quite as well. It wasn't quite as relevant in a theater, I guess.
Wow. So I know. So basically, that was the Mondo video was a whole bunch of different segments. You all were part of that segment. The whole concept of it was basically dealing with censorship at the time. Wow, that's interesting.
Well, I think a lot of it was. It was about sensibilities and perception, and you know, that was just part of it.
Right.
So. There was Sid Vicious, the My Way. We've all seen that.
Right.
Comes upstairs, you know, and singing My Way and shoots and everybody or whatever. So then there was Laser Bra 2000 and Swim School for Cats and stuff like that. So
Laser Bra 2000, they're still doing that sort of a running show on the Saturday Night Live digital films. You know, they'll come in. To sell Lorne Michaels on some film, and it's basically Laser Bra 2000, or Cats with Laser Beam Eyes or something.
Nice.
But I think, there wasn't anything really offensive in the show. Nothing you didn't see on Happy Days, you know.
It wasn't graphic or overt. It just was troublesome, I guess, you know.
Right. Subversive, yeah.
Yeah, so fans, better word.
They were actually understanding your subversion. Okay, interesting. So then with the Zoom, so there would have been a Zoom tour, right? I mean, how did radio stations and all at this point in time start? Did they start looking at you? Were they still afraid of you? Or what was going on?
Well, Dare to Be Fat got some airplay, as I recall.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
I guess with it's something at that point in time, Slim, who was certifiably crazy, he had to take some pretty heavy medication for schizophrenia,
Those dueling is not, that's not fiction. I mean, that's
yeah,
pretty much.
In fact, most of the material in the songs come from real life experiences and psychotic episodes in his life. He did jump over the White House fence.
He did steal a street sweeper.
Yeah. He did try to, he did drive an ice cream truck.
And he was the first guy over the White House fence since the War of 1812.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And it took him a half an hour to realize he was there.
Yeah, it's funny. when he stole a street sweeper, he was trying to go to the Jimmy Carter Center.
Yeah.
To see Jimmy Carter.
That's too funny.
When the Secret Service found him on the White House lawn, he said he was looking for the center of the universe.
Right.
He got separated from his papers, as he put it, in Jamaica a couple of times. Right. And wound up in, you know, some snake pit in Jamaica that required some State Department interference to get him out. But you know, there's Too Sick to Reggae comes out of that.
Okay.
I got it. He took a brick to the face in D.C. going to see James Brown when he was a teenager still, I guess.
Yeah.
Ouch.
That really messed up his dentition and his, you know, he had some scars from that. It was a pretty bad deal.
Yeah, I would imagine. Wow.
So anyway, with all this, it had been pretty much a 2-year run at that point. This was like the end of 79, early 1980. Mm-hmm. You know, two major label deals kind of came and went. Almost got on national television. A tour with Ian Dury and the Blockheads in England. So it's one thing after another for 2 years, just bam, bam, bam. Happened fast, and we were just all having a blast. And then I guess Slim had a little time to reflect and decided he didn't really need anybody. He was going to go on as a solo performer, and pretty much just fired everybody.
Wow. So what was that all about? What brought it to that point?
I don't know. He was crazy.
So, yeah, crazy. Okay.
There was a serious ebb and flow to his insanity, you know. Most of the time he was fine, really, but when he would get off his kazip, as he used to say, he could become so pretty much antisocial, and even though he might love you, he didn't want to do anything, you know, and he was stubborn about it. And so we Bob and I got sued. We got sued, you know, as a corporation or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to go to Superior Court in D.C. and there was a judgment against us for a show that we didn't do because Slim wouldn't do it with us, and we begged him to do it. So I said, man, we're going to get sued. We already have an advance on it. And come on, let's just do the show. No, I'm not doing it. So we offered to do it with, you know, someone else, you know, trying to put together a show, you know, the same band with just whoever we could get in front.
Right.
But the promoter wouldn't go for it, and so they had us, and all we could do was accept a judgment, and that was a mean-ass judge, too.
Yeah, I know. It's the luck of the draw when you go to court.
So it was kind of, you know, all this energy and the 2 years all just kind of fell by the wayside. And I remember Slim coming by, a few months later, came by to visit one day, and I just told him, I said, and he wasn't doing anything at that thing anyway. He realized, what the hell did I just do? But I said, Slim, you know, we'll all eventually pull ourselves together, get our lives back on track, and move on. You are unfortunately are going to be Root Boy Slim for the rest of your life now. Have fun with it.
And you know, the thing is, he got mad at Bob again. And then this was a problem for a while. I didn't even know what it was about originally. I think, you know, he felt, I don't even want to go into that.
Right, no need to.
but I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, you know, or relatives or whatever. But anyway, there was a perception that Slim had that was uncomfortable for him. And so he was unhappy with Bob and didn't want to work with Bob. So he enlisted me to produce the third album, Dog Secrets, which I agreed to do. And it was a whole different deal with some... a DC attorney. I don't want to go on all the stuff.
Yep.
No names, no whatever. But yep. Anyway, you know, I was offered a pretty, you know, reasonable deal to do it financially, and that just I went and did it, and I think we made a good album. After I left, a couple of tunes were substituted, and as a producer, that's kind of not, you know, kind of a no-no. Man, I produce a record, and then after I leave town, some substitutions have been made without any call to me even. So I was kind of unhappy about that, and unhappy about not getting paid what I was promised. But overall, I mean, as far as working with Slam and those, and the DC, the musicians that with whom we were affiliated and with who backed Slam up at those days in life, Slam's band in DC, he had a bunch of great players up there, man, and that was spot working with all those guys. And we did that record, and there's some great stuff on it. There's some great, very memorable tunes on it. So I still love that record. I'm happy about it. I just wish the decisions hadn't been made after, you know, ex post facto.
Right. Yeah, well, that changes the whole dynamic when someone steps in and does corrections, so to speak, to a piece of work. You know, it's like it's changing an artist's perception of what's supposed to be on the album. And I would imagine that would definitely not be a good thing.
There were definitely, there were a few too many cooks on that album.
So there you go. Well, see, the thing is, I cooked it and left town, and then
right, yeah, somebody recooked it, yeah,
bastards, yeah.
Reheated.
But it's still a great. It's a good album, and like Ernie said, there's some really great material on there. Inflatable Doll, Cowboy with the Sun Too Long.
Liquor Store Hall Up in
Liquor
Space.
Liquor Store Hall Up in Space, one of my profits.
Death Star.
Yes. And that one, Death Star, was pretty much just you, Bob, and Slim down at the... And that one really didn't get...
Yes, ma'am, had Bob Greenlee's junior. Bob, what, the fourth? He was still a kid. He had his little space gun, zip gun or whatever, little space gun. It making these, that's the effects on there, the spaceship. And we would pan it right to left and right to left to right, and, you know, zoom it all around between the speakers. But that is really a cool little record. I mean, a lot of people think that's their favorite tune, you know.
And very... prescient tune too, just about destroying the planet and
right, and about the, you know, the Middle East and about the Republicans, yeah. You know, that thing. Yeah, it was again prescient, and just as it was in World War III with Afghanistan carnage and you know, he was. And the Shah is gone. We were somehow right there on the bead, you know.
Well, you were sort of ahead of the curve because you were dealing with topics that really musicians wouldn't deal with, you know. I mean, because that's what I say. I mean, you're a fun group, everything's tight. But if you listen to the words of a lot of songs, even if they sound strange and afflicted, but if you listen to what they're saying, it's like, whoa, that's pretty deep. I mean, it's like there was thought put into the whole thing.
Well, absolutely. And while some of it may be very spontaneous, I think you'll find it, you know, the stuff bears repeated listening, and they're like tangential references that sometimes it just amazed me to this day. I mean, Slim was just, he was a brilliant, brilliant cat.
Mm-hmm. So then, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, a lot of people just on the surface, you know, might have written him off as sort of a novelty act, like a Ray Stevens or something, or Doug Clark and the Hot Nuts or something. Mm-hmm. But But no, he, you know, this stuff went a lot deeper than that. It had a lot of buffoonery on the outside, maybe, but like you said, there were, you go down by underneath, get past that, and there's some right. pretty heavy stuff in there.
Underneath the CD surface, the CD exterior,
yes.
serious insight into the human condition, I have to say.
Oh, because,
in his characters, I mean, he revealed a lot about himself through his characters and things like In Loneliest Room and other tunes that are very expository. And I don't know. They're just very touching. A lot of the stuff.
Oh, yeah, totally.
He wasn't just singing I Love You, Baby version 2B, you know?
It was coming
from somewhere. Unless he could get a laugh out of it.
Right.
Like, and they don't sing in the, they don't sing on the corner, you know, anymore.
Right.
That's what's a great tune, man.
Yeah, well, and
you know, a musician's a great Tommy Lepsum, great DC iconic musician, B3 player, singer, great all around guy. He just did a fantastic job with us. After Winston, it was kind of strange because Tommy was also like this redhead, you know, freckled B3 player, soul singer, just like Winston, like the DC version of Winston. It was a strange thing. Anyway, he really helped us out a lot. I love that guy, but they don't sing on the corner. He did sing all that beautiful background harmony and stuff, and just a shout out to Tommy Lepsum.
Yeah.
Wow. So, okay, shoot, I'm running out of time here because I could talk to you guys forever. So did you all play basically up till Ruth Boy's death, or what was it between what we've been talking about and when he died? What, 92 or 93?
He died in 93.
We did 6 albums all together. We did... help me out, Dave.
There's the Warner Brothers album, Zoom, Dog Secrets, Don't Let This Happen to You, Left for Dead, and Route 6.
The six Route album. 6.
So 6 albums, and all the albums were, you know, pretty much... the core of Ernie, Bob, and Root Boy doing the material and producing. Just before he died, the Sex Change Band, he had reunited the Sex Change Band. They were getting ready to go out on a East Coast tour. So it was Bob and Ernie and Winston, I think Albert on drums, Ron Holloway on sax, and they had just done the first kickoff show down in Orlando at a club called The Junkyard. And some guys from Roots, he had some friends in West Palm Beach, and some guy, Bob told me, he said that I never met in the few years I've been with Slim. They called him Perkadan Pete. Came and took Slim away for the weekend. And who knows what they did, but he came back to Orlando and made his way home. And his landlord, friend of his, he was renting a basement apartment from. Al Hughley, great guy, came in to check on him because he noticed he'd had his TV on and then he had turned it off or something. Anyway, he came in and found him and called the paramedics because he hadn't moved for a day. And the paramedics said they'd never seen a more peaceful expression on anyone's face. And they found him. So he died with a smile on his face.
Went out in style.
I remember Dick on that, we did this after the Route 6 record, and you did this great logo and shirt, and you know, the tour dates on it. We did Bob and Slim and I went out with Ronnie Bird Foster, the late great Ronnie Bird Foster on drums, who played with Roy Buchanan for 6 years, I think, and just a fantastic drummer, singer, and rest in peace, Bird. We did this East Coast tour that was just, we called it the 69th Amendment Tour, as you remember.
Yeah.
You did. Anyway, it was a great experience. Just in the smallest band we ever carried or played with, it was quite a workout for me, I tell you that, trying to cover some of those parts. But Ron did a few of the dates with us in D.C. and New York and a couple of, but anyway, just, I'll be brief, but that was that, I think.
So you have recordings of those shows?
Yeah.
There are some live shows of that, some live recordings of that.
That sounds interesting.
And we've got a lot of video and photography. We've been working for past few years on a documentary we're putting together on the whole Root Boy story. So we're hoping to try and wrap that up this year and get it out.
Now, you all have a website. What's the website?
Rootboyslim.com.
Okay.
We have a email list, which we will keep people informed of any progress we make. We're kind of taking our time and reading through all the archives. But and he's also on Facebook. Root Boy Slim's on Facebook. He's got a Facebook page. So anybody interested, chime in. Let us know who you are. We'll keep you posted on what's coming down the pike. We're not done with Root Boy yet.
So then there will be maybe a gathering of former musicians and band members and maybe a concert tour or a couple shows or what?
We've been talking about it. We've done about three times since he died. We've gotten together and done little tribute shows, which have just been a blast to do. And there's so many just great players over the years who played with him. We've got sort of a core group of Tommy Lepson, Deanna Bogart, Ron Holloway, Ernie, Scott Ambush, who also plays with Spyro Gyra. So that's sort of the core band. But then we've got all these other players, Stuart Smith and all these other people that play with him. So we are, we hope to do every time we've done those shows, it's just been just a huge amount of fun for us. And Tommy Lepson usually handles the vocal chores. And the crowd's just, you know, it's almost, you feel Root Boy at these shows just because he's in all of our DNA at this point. And we still, you know, the rehearsals don't take long at all. Even though none of us have played these songs in years, we get together and, you know, just bam, it all just falls right together. And the shows that we've done been great. So, we've been talking about maybe doing the Root Boy Slim All-Stars and putting them on the road.
Oh, that'd be spectacular. It's sort of funny how you say it's in your DNA because, like, I didn't have any albums for the longest time because you lend albums out and people don't give them back. But the songs were always in my head, and I, you know, and it was funny when I was going through a record store and I saw the Root Boy Slim and Sex Change Band, and I'm like, oh my God, someone gave it up. Cool. So, you know, I got it, and there's a guy behind me. He's going, oh, well, that was their best album. And I'm like getting up going, what are you talking about, their best album? All their albums were their best album, you know. Like, don't even start with me, you know. I don't want to fight in the record store here. But, you know, to me, it's one of the most iconic bands that I've ever experienced just because of its originality. It's the comfort that the musicians seemed to have, even if there was things going on, whatever. But when the music came on or was in the show, it just flowed and was very impressive. And I felt lucky to be able to see you all play live. You know, that's up there in the top 10, you know.
That's great.
Well, Tim, we love you, man.
Yeah, you guys are great. Okay, so I'll be looking forward. So any last words, Ernie?
I'd like to take about 10 seconds to just remember someone
you can take longer.
The great, the unsung Rudette, Kathy Special K. Russell. I'd like to mention Kathy Russell. She appeared on our first album as well, and she was a wonderful, sweet spirit and wonderful singer. And I didn't want her to go unmentioned.
That, yeah, Kathy Special K. And Mickey Johnny, who was on the first album too, just last year. So we've lost a few along the way.
And we'd send special wishes out to our friend, our beloved friend Shotgun Slim, Jeff Powell in Virginia, who's suffering from cancer at this point right now, and he's not doing well. And we love him, and we wish him the best.
Yeah. Yeah. Amen.
As we do too. Huh. Okay. Well, any final words? Are you guys all set?
Boogie to you.
Okay. Well, thank you all very much.
Yeah. One thing. Let me thank you. We really appreciate you, and thank you so much for digging us.
Hey.
Yeah. Thanks for having us on, and for hearing the music.
Hey, I love it. Okay, well, you all take care. It was a true pleasure, and I will remember this and cherish this moment for the rest of my freaking life. And hope to be hearing about you, and if you're playing in D.C. and stuff, I will definitely try to get down there.
All right.
All right, let's hold it down now.
Damn, you're good. Ugh. I love talking to Southern boys. It gets a little lonely up here in New England, let me tell you.
Well, I got my duck roll right here. It's handy, that's all.
Wow. Wow.
You that was you. I thought you just put a track on.
You want to play something for like a minute? That sounds pretty freaking good.
I don't mind.
Go ahead. Play us something. I want to hear it. Damn, boy, you're freaking good.
Ernie Sex Ray Lancaster.
Night, y'all.
All right, take it easy, and thanks again, Ernie.
Thank you, bud.
Hey, yeah. Tim, can we get a tape of the show sometime?
Yeah, I'll figure out something, and I'll make it work.
All right, great.
And we'll keep in touch, and I'll send it to you.
And I got you. I'll keep you on the Root Loop list, too.
All right, I'm there.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, take care
now. This is fun. We got Skype figured out now.
I know. I don't feel like such a moron anymore. Okay, take care, Dick.
All right, see ya. See ya, Ernie.
Bye. See ya, Ernie. Oh, wow. That was exciting for me. That was one of the funnest interviews I've had. Not that all of them haven't been fun, but this one was just like, I'd never, as I say, never interviewed someone that I thought was freaking amazing, you know, awestruck, you know. And yeah, for those of you that never got to witness the Root Boys Slim show, you missed out. I missed out. I mean, it was like total mayhem in a controlled kind of way. It was just totally like crazy, but excellent. So anyway, on that note, Root Boy, wherever the hell you are, I know you're freaking doing something nuts. And, hey, let's go out with one of their big all-time hits.
Put a quarter in the juke. Boogie till you puke. Pop that like a room. Let's really do. Shooting at a tune. All night long, the party lasts till your brain cells gone. Get on down and boogie tonight. Don't hold nothing back. You know it's all.
see, so for those of you always wondering why I'm sort of the way I am, Southern people just have their moments, so to speak. We can't help ourselves, it just sort of works that way. Crazy, but down to earth and nice in most cases. A little twisted and might look at you strange in certain situations, but yeah. And it's interesting talking novelty album. It's like novelty, but again, you start listening to it and it's like, oh, all right, there's a little commentary going on here. Awestruck. And you're listening to WMRWLP Warren 95.1 FM and streaming live at WMRW.org.